My name is Gadad Rahuli Das, and I work as the religious life advisor from the Hindu Student Organization and the Bhakti Club on campus. And I'd like to thank all of you and welcome all of you to this really, really wonderful event that has been organized by Columbia University's Bhakti Club. Now I'd like to introduce our moderator for the evening, Dr. Edwin Bryant. Dr. Edwin Bryant received his PhD in Indic Languages and Cultures from Columbia University. He has taught Hinduism at Harvard for 3 years and is presently the professor of Hinduism at Rutgers University, where he teaches courses on Hindu philosophy and religion.
I'll begin with Radhanath Swami. Radhanath Swami is a Vaishnava sannyasi, so he's in the renounced order. Sannyasi is a celibate order of a Vaishnava tradition, which is focused on Vishnu as the supreme being. And he's the author of the text that I think is probably sitting at the back of the room over there, called The Journey Home, which is a memoir of his search for spiritual truth. He was born Richard Slavin in 1950, and in his teens he came to confront a deep sense of alienation from suburban Chicago life and the civil injustices of mid-century America. At the age of 19, Radhanath Swami, while on a summer trip to Europe, his internal struggles culminated in a commitment to search for God, wherever it might lead him. Meditating on the Isle of Crete, he felt a calling, and the next morning set off alone to find spiritual India. The Journey Home documents his odyssey as a penniless hitchhiker through Greece, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and finally India. This is back in the 60s and 70s where you could still hitchhike across Asia. I think that overland route closed around 1978 with the when the Shah left, and then of course the Afghan War began. But up until that point, you could actually hitchhike. There was a well trodden path across Asia from Europe to India. So the Journey Home documents this. There he lived as a wandering ascetic, first amongst the forest-dwelling Himalayan yogis, and later amongst a wide variety of gurus and spiritual practitioners throughout India and Nepal. Ultimately, he was led to the holy town of Vrindavan, where he found his path amongst the bhakti yogis. In Vrindavan, he found the teacher he was searching for in A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. A Gaudiya Vaishnava lineage, which stems back to 16th century Chaitanya, an incarnation of Krishna that is accepted by the tradition as an incarnation of Krishna, called Sri Chaitanya. You know you're getting old when you can't even read when you've got spectacles sitting on your face. In choosing Bhaktivedanta Swami as his guru, Radhanath Swami felt compelled to shear his matted locks and re-enter Western society with a mission to share the sacred wisdom he had received. This return exemplifies the form of devotional yoga which is at the heart of Radhanath Swami's teachings. At the age of 31, he took the monastic vows of a Vaishnava sannyasin and became known as Radhanath Swami. Today, Radhanath Swami travels regularly throughout India, Europe, and North America, sharing the teachings of Bhakti Yoga. He resides much of the year at the Radha Gopinath Ashram in Chowpatty, Mumbai. For the past 25 years, he has guided the community's development and has directed a number of acclaimed social action projects, including Midday Meals, which daily serves more than 260,000 plates of vegetarian food to the children of the slums of Mumbai. He has also worked to establish missionary hospitals and eye camps, eco-friendly farms, schools and ashrams, an orphanage, and a number of emergency relief programs throughout India. Welcome, Maharaj. And with us also today, we have Father Francis Xavier Clooney, who was born in Brooklyn in 1950. So, you're the same age.
Mm-hmm. Good planning.
he was raised in Staten Island in a devout Catholic family. He served as an altar boy and went to Regis, a Jesuit high school in Manhattan. At age 15, Father Clooney had a very strong moment of a sense of vocation and called to priesthood, and just after his 18th birthday, entered the Jesuit order. He took his vows as a Jesuit in 1970, vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and was ordained a priest in 1978, a role which he still takes seriously by saying Mass in a parish every Sunday. One other formative experience, after college, Father Clooney spent 2 years in Kathmandu, where he taught in a Jesuit school, where all the boys were Hindu and Buddhist. This opened his eyes to the reality and beauty of the religions of that part of the world. He joined the Harvard Divinity School in 2005. He is a Parkman Professor of Divinity and Professor of Comparative Theology. After earning his doctorate in South Asian Languages and Civilizations, University of Chicago in 1984, he taught at Boston College until coming to Harvard. His primary areas of scholarship are theological commentarial writings in the Sanskrit and Tamil traditions of Hindu India. Actually, I first met Father Clooney when I was in Cambridge. He's actually a very well-known Indologist and doesn't just do comparative work with the Hindu theistic traditions, but he wrote a book on Mimamsa, which is a very obscure kind of Indic philosophical school. He's actually non-theistic. And the first time I met you, actually, I don't even remember, I invited you, I was in my first year of teaching, feeling hopelessly out of my depth. Yeah. And I had to come to this in a Mimamsa for a course on Hindu philosophy, and I requested Professor Clooney to kindly come in and teach the course, that particular section for me, and he did, he's very gracious. Yeah. So he is a very well-regarded Indologist in our field. So, he has also written on the Jesuit missionary tradition, particularly in India, and the dynamics of dialogue in the contemporary world. Professor Clooney is the author of numerous articles and books, including most recently, Beyond Compare, St. Francis and Sri Vedanta Deshika on Loving Surrender to God, The Truth, The Way, The Life is the second book, Christian Commentary on the Three Holy Mantras of the Sri Vaishnava, Hindus, third book, Comparative Theology, Deep Learning Across Religious Borders, and so on. His current major project, tentatively titled A God Real Enough to Be Absent, is an exercise in dramatic theology, exploring the absence of God in accord with the biblical Song of Songs and the Hindu word of mouth. He was elected a fellow of the British Academy, and since 2010, he's also the director of the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard Divinity School. I have no idea how he managed to fit all that in. So what I thought is, I'd like to request our two speakers to perhaps begin with sharing some words about their own spiritual journeys, about how they got to be where they are, about the calling that I touched upon that they both felt at a very young age, to share with us something about their own spiritual journeys, and then to perhaps also say something about this program is called Encountering God, and perhaps say something about what that means for them in their tradition. What is God in their respective tradition? Who or what is God in their respective tradition? And what is this encounter? So I thought we could start off with each of our speakers speaking for, say, 15 minutes, and then we'll initiate a questions from you all. So I think you all have cards that were handed to you as you came in, and if you'd care to write down, nice and clearly, questions, simple, try to keep them short. While our two speakers are addressing us, if you care to write down questions and pass them to the end, then we'll try to we'll try to engage as many of those as we can. My request would be, however, that the questions be directed for both of the speakers rather than just for one of them. So if you wish to ask a question, then somehow phrase a question that is going to engage both, because it is a comparative dialogue. If you could write a question that would engage both of our speakers, and it will be put to both of them. So now perhaps Father Clooney would be kind enough to 15 minutes just to share something about his journey and his understanding of the terms of encounter with God. Thank you.
So I'd just like to add my own word of pleasure at being here. Thank you all for coming out on this beautiful Friday afternoon. Thank you, Edwin, for your wonderful introduction. Very kind. Rana Swami, nice to be here with you and share this time with you. And I am very much looking forward to your questions. I think often I can think of things I can say to you, but your questions may be more interesting and more pointed, so please do don't be shy about posing questions. Professor Brian has already said much of what I would say in introducing myself, and let me just kind of weave together something about the Catholic-Christian understanding of encountering God with my own story within it. Catholic Church, big religion, old, very much part of Western civilization, global civilization, and very much part of New York. So I was born in Brooklyn, New York, in an Irish Catholic family, staunch Catholic. In the 50s, things still held together fairly cohesively. And I think in that climate, which for me, I think I was blessed with a family that was both pious and also concerned about understanding the faith. It wasn't just rote learning, it wasn't just repeating things that had been said, but some kind of learning to go with believing, believing to go with learning. So growing up Catholic in Brooklyn and then Staten Island, New York, I think it was very much a climate in which encountering God is really what life is about. And this is even before one would ask about being a mystic or having a personal spiritual journey or doing anything extraordinary. The belief, I think, of Catholic tradition had always been God is present in all things. God who created the world is present in the world at all times. Every tree, every flower, every accomplishment of human beings somehow manifests the creativity of God, and that God is all around us all the time. Within that context, we are helped in various ways. I think the tradition of the Church was by, for instance, Scripture, the Bible, that the Word of God in many ways spoke the story of... Thank you. Spoke of God's work in the world, the stories of God's intervention in the life of the Jewish people, God's presence in Jesus who walked the earth. And I think we were meant to kind of learn from the book of nature and then learn from the book of the Bible. And then, like any strong and developed religious tradition, there was also an expectation that the practices of our faith, be it prayers before meals, morning prayers, evening prayers. When I was a child, we would gather family and say the rosary together. But also going to church, going to Mass, going to benediction, singing the hymns, doing the sacraments of the church. All of this was encounter of God, you might say, in ordinary time. Even before anything special happened in your life, you grow up in this context. God was everywhere around you. God was in the church. God was in the way we lived our lives. Not that it was always easy for people, but I think it was present that the point of being a religious person in a religious tradition is that God is nearby, not simply far away. It was also an educated tradition, so I went to a very good Catholic primary school in Staten Island, New York. I went to Regis High School, Jesuit High School, over on 85th Street near Park Avenue, a very good school. We learned Latin, we learned Greek, we studied the scriptures, we studied the tradition, and this kind of great world of learning that was already opened up. And I think maybe because it was a Jesuit school, there was always the sense that there's no need to be afraid of what happens if a faithful person studies very hard, or if a person who's a scholar also tries to be a believer. And that sometimes people can be apprehensive that if I study too much, I'll lose my faith. Or if I have faith, this will ruin my scholarship. But I think that tradition which I grew up in was that these are the two sides of who God is. The beauty, the power, the emotion of the experience of God, and the truth, and that knowing, understanding, questioning, seeking, and believing are things that go together. So that was sort of the general context of the encountering God in Catholic tradition in which I grew up. 1960s, when I was in high school and then in college at Fordham, the whole thing was crumbling and falling apart. And we can talk about that later. What happens when the 60s hit the Catholic Church, or the 70s, or the 80s, and the scandals that came along and so on. All of these things are around our consciousness, but I think as a starting point, that the pieces were together and one could grow up in that environment in a harmonious fashion. I think that the things that I would say to characterize how I fit into that would be only several, and then I'll stop. First of all, that, again, I think I was privileged that I didn't need to go seeking for an alternative. I didn't need to somehow look and say there has to be something else. But that it was very much a sense that within the great kind of wealth of the church and the possibilities of the church, I could find my home there. And I think all my life I've been sort of an intellectual professor, not your typical parish priest, to be sure. But there was always a sense that it's possible to do all of this. One can be involved in all these things. But as Dr. Bryant mentioned, when I was 15, within that context, had a very powerful experience of God. It was a momentary experience, one day in the summer of 1966, that gave me a sense that within this great Catholic world, I was called to be a priest and to serve in the church, to take on this special role that most Catholics my age would not take on, even if they were church-going, but somehow to be called to this particular vocation within the church of service, of ministry in the church. As you know, Catholic priests don't marry, so right from the start, it implied being celibate, living not so much a monastic life, but the Jesuit life of somehow living poverty, chastity, obedience in the world, and somehow being dedicated to God, but open to the world around us. And I think that simple experience, I really didn't have a crisis of faith. I didn't question the things I had been brought up with. But within all of that, a very intense moment that all of this is calling me to change my life. This is calling me to be a follower of Christ in this special way. And so, as Edwin mentioned, I entered the Jesuit order just after I turned 18. I did my novitiate studies, the first seminary studies in Poughkeepsie, New York. I did my college studies at Fordham University. The second choice, really, of the three that I'll just point out to you that came to me in that mix was, what kind of a priest do you want to be? And there are many different ways in which people are Catholic priests. But I think for me, perhaps because of the environment I grew up in and the Jesuit training and so on, is, as I said before, not to be afraid of the points where faith and understanding cross paths. Not to be afraid of asking every question and claiming you can still be a believer. Not being the kind of person who would think, are you a scholar or a pious person? Are you a devotee or a university professor? And somehow within my Jesuit vocation, when I could have been a parish priest or a hospital chaplain, or I could have worked in innumerable ways in schools and so on, I felt that God was also saying, use your head, use your brains. Learn the languages, studies, find your way. Don't be afraid of what you learn, because the truth is God, God is the truth. And so to be a scholar, get a PhD, teach in the university, first at Boston College, now at Harvard, all of that was sort of something I found in the 70s. You're going to be a priest, but what kind of a priest? Okay, you're going to be a scholar priest, and to let that happen. And then the third thing, which Dr. Bryant pointed out, was why India became part of it. And I remember very vividly, it was 1972, there was a conference at Le Moyne College in Syracuse, where on the international work of Jesuits. So after the Vatican Council, the world opening up, we're becoming one globe, one world. And in that context, there was a conference about being an American Jesuit and being a global Jesuit, being here and being connected. And one of the speakers, in a very simple way, is a great historian, but in a very simple way, simply said, your vocation as a Jesuit is to have a heart as large as the world. Don't put boundaries on your heart. Don't limit yourself. Imagine across the boundaries. Feel the suffering of people everywhere. Empathize with people everywhere. Let your heart be as large as that world. And so I had the chance to teach. I needed to teach as part of my training. I asked if I could go to South Asia. In the 70s, it was hard to get a visa in India, so I went to Kathmandu, taught in the school for 2 years. And I think, as Edwin said, all the boys in the school were Hindu and Buddhist, but to teach them, I had to learn from them. And in order to be in the classroom with them, it was a boarding school, I was with them all day and night, 24 hours a day kind of thing. But I had to open myself to them. What does it mean to be a young Hindu, a young Buddhist in the 70s in Kathmandu? What is it for me, at 22 years old, meeting them and beginning to share our lives? It opened up for the door for me that, sure, you're a Catholic, sure, you're a Catholic priest, sure, you're a Jesuit, but all of this opens up into these bonds of friendship, crossing religious boundaries, visiting the holy places, the temples in Kathmandu, and realizing that the experience, the loves, the fears, the sorrows, the joys of these boys I was teaching and their parents and their families was somehow going to be part of my life. And so when it came to me as an academic Jesuit, what would I do for studies? I decided that I needed to cement that bond and do studies in Hinduism to kind of cement the fact that I would be learning, always learning, and always studying my own tradition, but also be open to and learning from the traditions of India, particularly the Hindu traditions. So it didn't come as a great plan. It didn't come as a great project, but I kind of walked into it by realizing that these pieces could fit together, being Catholic, being a priest, being dedicated to the intellectual life and learning from Hinduism was all within this great frame of encounter with God. And I think that's what I've tried to live out all these years as a Jesuit and a priest, and I think maybe that's enough for us to start with.
Om Akyan Timidandasya Jnananjana Chalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanshakalpa Tharubhyascha Kripa Sindubhya Evacha Patithanam Bhavanibhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasiti Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
It's a very great honor for this opportunity to be with all of you. Thank you for being with us. Thank you, Father Clooney, for your beautiful, heart-piercing realizations. And from my experience of my readings and my brief interactions with Father Clooney is from the perspective of any spiritual path, any faith, any religion, he is really an exemplary saintly person. It's really an honor that you came today. Thank you, Dr. Bryant, for bringing us together. I was brought up, as was explained, in northern Illinois and passed through my teenage years in the very confusing days of the 1960s. I'll just say a few things. I remember when I was 15, excuse me. You are excused. I guess you should excuse me. When I was 15, I worked at a car wash. And almost all of the fellow employees were African Americans from the ghettos of the south side of Chicago. And something really hit me. These people, they were so beaten down by poverty, by racial discrimination, practically by a sense of hopelessness that led them all to alcoholism. And they were making the same amount of money as me after school, and they were maintaining entire families. And at that time in the 1960s, if you were born as an African American in the ghetto, then it was almost without any alternative that you would live and you would die in that ghetto. At the same time, there was this Vietnam War raging, and when you turn 18, you're either drafted to fight a war that you don't believe in, or you go to jail. These were real questions based on real experiences. My friends at that car wash, they loved me and I loved them. And I was taught to believe that America was a land of freedom and liberty for all. But it seemed it was very discriminatory. The counterculture raged a revolution against the values of the older generation and the apparent hypocrisies. I was a part of it. But as time went on, I came to understand that the real change that has to be there is spiritual. I heard from Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world. Unless there was a revolution against the tyranny of ignorance, envy, hatred, and greed within ourselves, then we really can't be a part of a substantial change within the world. I knew it was spiritual, but at the same time, I recognized, being born in a Jewish family, people in the name of God and religion hated me simply because of my religion. It seemed that there was even at times a greater prominence of arrogance, envy, greed, and hatred in the name of spirituality. So where was I to turn? But in my readings, and through my own intuition, I deeply believed at the essence of all these great spiritual paths, there was something very beautiful, very harmonizing, that could bring about true fulfillment, love, and compassion. And I wanted to find that. At the age of 19, myself and one friend, we went on a journey to search for that spiritual essence. And eventually I left my friend, and as was said, I decided to go to India. I hitchhiked 6 months from London to the Himalayas. On the way, in my own little way, I encountered God through Judaism, through Christianity, through Islam, through Buddhism, through many branches of Hinduism. And I felt a very serious life-transforming experience in each of these faiths. But I was seeking the essence. Wandering through the Himalayas, in 1970 on my own, I kind of took my own little vow of celibacy and poverty as a sadhu or a spiritual seeker, and eventually came to Vrindavan, a holy place of bhakti. Bhakti is the path of devotion and service. And in that experience in Vrindavan, which was a beautiful forest on the bank of the Yamuna River, I felt that I have been given entrance into my own personal spiritual home. It was my path where I felt I could encounter God in the essence of all great religions through that. And it was in Vrindavan that I met Srila Prabhupada, who was later to become my guru. And in him I found a wisdom that seemed to include everything I had learned, and a compassion and humility that deeply moved my heart. By that time, he had many followers in many parts of the world, and I remember somebody asked him, "Are you the guru of the world?" And I met so many gurus who really thought they were the gurus of the world. And Srila Prabhupada put his head down in great humility, and he said, "No, I am simply the servant of everyone. That's all." His love for God, his compassion for all beings, his wisdom very much gave me an encounter of God, and I decided to dedicate myself to assisting him. That was in 1971. In 1982, the community around me very much persuaded me to take the vows of a Swami, which is a monk in the Hindu order. And the idea is we refrain from having many possessions or family so that we could make the whole world our family without any distractions. In our tradition, to encounter God, I'll try to explain very briefly that there are three primary features of God. The first is Brahman, the all-pervading, formless, impersonal absolute. And to reach that state is called mukti, or liberation. The second aspect of God is Paramatma, the Lord who is seated within the heart of every living being, who is the witness, and if we can tune in to his presence, is the guide within us, the source of intuition. And the third aspect of God is Bhagavan, which means the supreme personality of Godhead. Bhagavad means the Lord as the supreme person, whose body, whose form, his personality is Satchit-Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss, whose personality is the ultimate origin and the possessor of infinite beauty, infinite knowledge, infinite wealth, infinite fame, infinite renunciation, humility, and ultimately infinite grace and love. In other words, all attractive. The name Krishna is not a sectarian concept. It's a name of the one Supreme Lord, which means the all-attractive one, who is the supreme controller and the all-powerful creator, but above and beyond that, beauty, love, sweetness, and grace is where we could commune with that God. In the Bhagavad Gita, it tells paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chaduskritam, that that Bhagavan, that supreme Lord, descends into this world again and again and again through the ages, with different forms, sometimes with different names, according to the time, the place, and the people, to deliver the same essential message of how to cleanse our hearts and awaken that love that we have for him and be an instrument of his compassion in everything we do and everything we say. sarva karana karanam. That this God, the Supreme Truth, is the source of everything. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells that I am the source of the sun, the light of the sun, the light of the moon, the taste of water, all the abilities of men and women. I'm the source of all intelligence. And in this, Krishna is explaining how we can encounter him, as Father Clooney was explaining, through nature, within ourselves, and in every situation. When we see the sun, we understand it is God's grace that is giving us the light of the sun. It is God's grace that is giving us our food, that is giving us the power to think, to move, and to actually experience in that way. Srila Prabhupada once said, when he was asked, how do we see God in everything? He pointed to his glasses, or in India we call them spectacles. He said, what do you think of when you see these spectacles? And the devotee said, I think that these are my Guru Prabhupada's spectacles. He said, so you are seeing me in those spectacles. And what happens when you see the spectacles? And the person says, when I think of you, my love for you, my gratitude to you comes. He said, everything is the property of God. That's the way we should see everything. One time he was walking in California along the Pacific Ocean and a beautiful sunset was taking place. And somebody said, isn't this a beautiful sunset? And he said, if you think the art is beautiful, you should see the artist. This is just a spark of the splendor of the artist. In other words, we can encounter God according to our spiritual level of realization, wherein we are conscious of God's presence within us, within others, within the world. There's a beautiful verse in the Gita, Vidyavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gavihasti, which means that in a real learned person is one who sees everyone with equal vision. Despite one's religion, one's color, despite one's sex, or even species, we see that life is sacred. Wherever there is life, there is a part of God. In our tradition, there's a beautiful verse, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sajja Kabunoi, Sravanadi Sudhi Chiti Kuriyayutoi, that love of God is within the heart of every living being. That all attractive, beautiful Krishna is within the heart of every living being. And the purpose of spirituality, the purpose of religion, is to cleanse our hearts and actually reconnect with our own essence of that love. And to the degree we reconnect through our spiritual practice and our good character, integrity in life, to that degree we actually feel, we experience the infinite love of God for us, and we naturally reciprocate through our love and our gratitude. And that is expressed through bhakti or seva, through service. My guru used to say, don't try to see Krishna, but try to serve Krishna with such love that he's happy to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. So we can start now with some questions. I'll start with the first question, just as a moderator, and meanwhile, hopefully, someone is collecting some of the questions. And I'd like to invite our two speakers to say something about how do you encounter God in each other's traditions? Father Clooney, we were just reading in our Hindu film class the Yatindamata Deepika, which is a text in the Sri Vaishnava tradition that you are an expert in. And in it, there's a passage where the liberated soul approaches God and there's the throne of God, and it really sounds like something that could have been coming right out of the Old Testament. But then, of course, upon the throne is the four-armed Vishnu form. So my question is, how far do you go in your studies? How far do you encounter God in the Sri Vaishnava tradition, especially? And where do you sort of draw a line? Do you draw a line at some point where your Christian sensitivities don't allow you to step beyond that? And Swami Ratna, yourself too, how do you encounter God in the Christian tradition? And as we come from a Jewish family, so what was it about Judaism? What did you encounter there or not encounter there that somehow caused you to seek further afield? So that's a question for both of you. How do you encounter God in each other's traditions?
To put it in a very broad frame and then give a personal twist to it, I think the Catholic tradition to which I belong at least sees itself as having been always in the position of learning from outside itself. I think we know today, but I think it was intuited early on in the tradition, you can't be Christian unless you're in some way rooted in your Jewish roots. You have to know the Jewish tradition. There is no Christian without Jewish. The Greek learning, the learning of the Mediterranean, the Greek world, the Latin world, this kind of vast complex of rich, what was called pagan culture, that somehow this was where the church would flourish. The New Testament, the words of Jesus, were from the very beginning in Greek, not in Aramaic or Hebrew, but there's this great process of translation going on. So this effort kind of growing, there's always kind of the challenge of the intellectual, the challenge of stepping outside one's comfort zone and learning from the other. And I think on the one side, this is an enormously powerful intellectual drive to know. And I think the tradition that I grew up with, the kind of Catholic I grew up with, never be afraid of the questions, always be learning. The great masters of Catholic tradition were studying Aristotle and Plato in the Middle Ages, the world of science, the world of evolution, the world of culture. Often there was a pushback by the church, but I think there was also a sense that all of this somehow is part of who we are. The other thing from the beginning of the church, which sometimes is seen as a bittersweet reality, is the mission of the church to the world. So from Jerusalem, from Palestine, across the Mediterranean, early Christians going to India, parts of Asia, over the Silk Road into China, all of this kind of outreach. And my own Jesuit tradition, which started in 1540, in 1542, the first Jesuit, Francis Xavier, went to India. And it began this kind of long process of the gospel cannot be preached unless you learn from the people to whom you were sent. Literally learning Chinese, learning Tamil, learning the languages of North and South America. There has to be this mutual learning process if anything is going to be communicated. And I think when I went to Kathmandu in 1973, it was kind of a last wave of that kind of the West going out to the world, that I went there as part of a mission. It was a Jesuit school in Kathmandu, but it was an educational institution in which, of course, learning would take place and impolitic questions would always be asked. In that context, I first encountered Hindu tradition. I remember very much hearing bhajans of Rama and Sita being sung by the boys in the school. I remember hearing for the first time about Sai Baba and received from one of the students some vibhuti that I still have in my office. Hearing the stories of Ramakrishna, who I loved as an individual and still do because of his incredibly passionate devotion to the mother, Kali, and the sense that everything is given to you if you love 100% the one who is your mother. And the sense that all of this spoke to me immediately, I think, that if I'm a Christian for whom Jesus is the center of reality, somehow that echoed, you might think it would be contradictory, but in a very improbable way it was symmetrical or harmonious with Ramakrishna loving his mother, or Rama and Sita in the utter devotion of Hanuman and Lakshmana and so on to them. So when I think I was trying to put this together intellectually, it was on the one level, learn as much as possible. And so Edwin mentioned before, I was studying Mimamsa, Purva Mimamsa, the ritual tradition, definitely not devotional, but somehow every boundary can be crossed, every question can be asked. You're a far better Catholic if you can understand an entirely different intellectual system. And then within that, gradually finding my way by reading the Gita, by teaching the Gita in Kathmandu, to the stories of Krishna, to the great intellectual traditions around the Gita, and then the beautiful poetry of South India, the Tamil poetry, the Bhakti tradition of the Alvars, and realizing that here too was 100% love of no one other than Narayana, or Krishna, or Lakshmi, Lakshmi Narayana, and that you give yourself entirely in that love and you see the entire world around it. And that it seemed to me that as a Catholic theologian, which I really consider myself to be, being an Indologist is a small part of that, is that somehow you have to open the doors, you have to ask the questions, you have to learn far more than you can digest from the other tradition, and then fall in love with it. And that as I fell in love with and remain in some way in love with my own tradition, learning the other and making it part of my own, and then the very difficult and unpredictable chemistry of bringing that together and making sense of it, particularly through the Vaishnava tradition for me. The last thing I would say is that Edwin referred to the book I'm finishing, reading the Song of Songs with the medieval Christian commentators, Bernard of Clairvaux and his successors. What attracted me about that is the utter abandonment in love of this young woman in the song, without any compromise. And Jesus is the beloved. Jesus is the bridegroom. And then saying, but that opens a door rather than closing it by reading the Alvar poetry and realizing that the young woman who's yearning for her Krishna wants nothing but Krishna, and that somehow that creates a resonance and a possibility with my own Catholic background. And then see, okay, what comes out of that? What questions arise? How can I write about that?
Beautiful. Thank you. When I was 19 on my journey, the greatest spiritual transformation I had experienced up till that time was in a beautiful cathedral of the Catholic Church in Florence, Italy. While I was praying and meditating before Lord Jesus on the altar, I had a life-changing experience. I try to describe it in the book, The Journey Home. And it was at that time, in that moment, that I decided that I would dedicate my life exclusively to the spiritual search. A grace came upon me in that beautiful cathedral that has nourished and empowered me in certain ways till today. I would visit many monasteries in Italy and learn from monks, priests. When I was in India, in Calcutta, I had a beautiful meeting with Mother Teresa, and I remember she told me something that I have carried in my heart every day as a very universal principle I strive for. She said that the problem in the world is hunger, not hunger of the stomach. That can be satisfied with some food, but hunger of the heart. And that hunger of the heart can only be nourished through love for God. And in that love for God, we could love everyone. The first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and the natural consequence of that is to love every neighbor of yourself. And everyone's your neighbor. And I remember when I was living in Vrindavan, and I had dedicated my life to this path of bhakti. One afternoon, it was actually late morning, I can visualize this moment as if it's happening now. I was sitting on the bank of the river Yamuna, and I was chanting Krishna and Radha's names. Radha is the feminine aspect of the Supreme Truth. In Vrindavan, and this is one of the things that really enchanted me, that God is both male and female, Radha Krishna. And Radha is the source of all grace. So as I was meditating like this, a very traditional, learned Babaji, or saintly person, he was wearing the robes, he was really a person to just fit right in Vrindavan as a saint. He sat next to me, and for about an hour we were discussing the intimate leelas of Radha and Krishna, the intimate esoteric philosophical stories of our tradition. It was so enlightening. He was so deep with love. And then before he left, he handed me a folded up piece of paper. And he said, "This has helped me to go so deeply into my love for Radha and Krishna. Please keep it with you and read it." And he left. I opened it up. And it was prayers of Saint Francis of Assisi. "My dear Lord, let me be an instrument of your peace." And I read through it, and I remember how I cried. How, yes, people really who are deep in their own tradition not only could not only tolerate other religious beliefs, not only appreciate, but actually dive deeply to enhance our own spiritual experience through the realizations of other religions. And this especially has always been a part of my life in connection with Christianity.
Okay, so I have a bunch of questions here. Obviously, we're going to get to more. What I intended, actually, in terms of writing a question that you could direct to both Swamiji and Father Clooney, is one question, the same question that both of them could respond to, not two questions. And then you wrote two questions, one for each of them, which obviously is not going to be able to. So, first question. Both of you, the question is, why do missionaries want to convert different traditions to theirs? In a sense, we're both part of missionizing traditions. The Hare Krishna is a missionizing tradition, which is a bit unusual for Hinduism, and certainly Christianity has a history of that. So why do your traditions feel this impulse to convert?
That same question was asked to my guru, Srila Prabhupada, right here in New York City. I think it was around 1966. They said, "Swamiji, why have you come to America? We have our own religion." And Srila Prabhupada's reply was, "I have not come to convert, I have come to enlighten, to help remind you of what we have within us, the great treasure of love for God that is within us, which is such a great need for the world." And he also explained that my success is not only to transform people to love Krishna according to my tradition, but if I could help a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim or a Jain or a Sikh to actually be a deeper lover of God in their own tradition, he said, "then I will accept it. I have done my service." So it is natural that we want to expand our own families, but at the same time, it's very crucial that it's done with honor and respect. It is a Vaishnav principle, amanina manadena. To not expect honor for ourselves, but to be very eager to offer honor to all others. And I think when there's a balance, then our missionary activities can have a very powerful impact and access a very powerful form of God's grace to us in the world.
Okay. This is obviously a big question, difficult question, and I think if we can take for granted the touchy nature of the question, the fact that obviously this has troubled relations among religions, particularly with Christian missionaries going out to the world, and known that often in India, for instance, this causes great disturbances. What is this about? And let's admit, too, that sometimes it is tied in with politics, hegemony, colonialism, imperialism, and that kind of sorting it out purely and saying it's just a spiritual thing in the Christian context is implausible because it's tied in with so many other factors. But I think taking all of that for granted, however messy it is, and also admitting and noticing that some Christian communities actually don't missionize, like some of the Orthodox communities of the East, once they're planted in a place, they seem quite happy simply to be there and don't feel any impulse to go around preaching or converting and so on. But I think within that context, people often point to several reasons. I mean, one is the mandates of Jesus in the Gospels. I am the way, the truth, and the life. There is no other name by which one is saved. Go forth and preach the gospel to all nations. Some sense that the initial work of Jesus in Palestine, in a very small area, the early Christian community took somehow to mean this is for everybody, and the sense of kind of the impulse out. Even though we know from Jesus' own ministry, very often he communicated with people, he had a profound effect on their lives, and didn't ask them to become followers, didn't ask them to leave behind their own tradition. The Canaanite woman, the Samaritan, the Roman soldiers, let them be as they were. And some people left everything and followed him. So there's the double message of the mission of the early church founded in Scripture, and also Jesus who often let people be. But when it becomes kind of speculative, and I'll just say this briefly and then stop, on the one side, I think mission became tied in with theories of salvation. That if it is true that Jesus loved the world so much that he died on the cross, then that is the way to salvation, that there's no other way to be saved. And some of the early Jesuit missionaries, like Francis Xavier, after whom I'm named, really believed that the people of Asia would not reach salvation except if they were somehow saved by the blood of Jesus Christ. And they went with, to us it may seem intruding on other cultures, but with a great sense of compassion, as many as possible to be saved. Other theories in the 19th, 20th century were about civilization, bringing people to full humanity, bringing people to this kind of Christic model of identity, and those things come and go. I think one of the best ways, maybe just to finish, would be today when missionaries go forth, some are clearly intrusive, objectionable, don't know what they're talking about, or tend to be offensive in the cultures to which they go, and others maybe on the best level are saying, this is so beautiful, it's so powerful, it's made such a difference in my life, I'd like to share it with you. And I think as long as that is not connected, as Swami said, with any compulsion or any necessity of getting you to join my community, being able to share what you care about most deeply with anybody can actually be a beautiful thing, even if it goes under the category of mission.
Sometimes notions of God seem so far and so impractical from the perspective of modern worldviews, and liberal understandings of faith seem immature, if I could just piggyback onto that. So how important is liberal understanding of your respective traditions? You have the Old Testament narratives, Father Clooney, mm-hmm. and Swami Ji, you have stories of Krishna and some of the demons that he kills, which clearly most people are going to see as mythological. So how important is a literal understanding of the scriptures? And if we let go of that literal understanding, then are we not just swimming in our own interpretations? Have we lost hope of the very anchor that gave us security in the first place? So, Father Clooney.
So these are tough questions we're getting. I think on one level, first of all, one has to admit that, let's say, if one just sticks for the moment with the biblical tradition, that there are a very large number of images of what God is like. If you start reading the books of the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, Hebrew Bible, New Testament, there are many different images. And I think part of the reason for that large repertoire of images is that some work better with some people. God the King, God the Beloved, God the Brother, God the Savior, God the one who feeds the poor. That images are different images for different people. And not to kind of become monolithic and say, well, if you don't like this image, you can't be one of us. But rather to see the door is open. Secondly, as I think Edwin was suggesting or implying, in the medieval tradition of Christian commentary, there's a kind of an allegiance to the literal meaning, that you have to take the words of the text literally and seriously. So the parting of the Red Sea, the multiplication of the loaves and fishes, Joshua stopping the sun in the sky so that the battle could be finished. You have to deal with what the text says, but if you stop there, you'll end up with this paradox. It doesn't make any sense. Who could possibly believe that? So the, a literal meaning that opens up the door to a kind of a moral meaning, a spiritual meaning, an ethical meaning, an esoteric love meaning. And if you read early commentators, the great fathers and mothers of the church, the Greek world, and then medievals like St. Bernard of Clairvaux and so on, they're saying, well, the literal meaning is this, and yet for us in our time and place, it becomes a metaphor. God creates out of nothing. I was nothing and God made me something. I was blocked by all these obstacles in my life. As God parted the Red Sea, God opened the way for me. When I was hungry, it was Jesus who came to me by the side of the road and cared for me. And some kind of play over the multiple meanings, the images of God, the images of being human. We don't live in an age of miracles. We don't believe in miracles for the most part. And yet somehow saying that somewhere inside us, things that have no apparent cause can happen. So it's a very complicated process, but I think it does really command of us, A, to take the text seriously, and then use the full range of our human, imaginative, intellectual, rational intelligence to get at this great set of possibilities.
Wonderful. Thank you. All I could do is say the same thing from my own language. I remember struggling with that too, whether it was the Old Testament or the New Testament or the stories of Krishna and the Srimad Bhagavat or the Mahabharata. There's quite fantastic things that go on. And are these to be taken as historical or are they just symbolic to teach us some lesson? And I found among not only the people who I was meeting, who were such deep embodiments of love, devotion, and compassion, but also entire histories of such persons, who took these stories as history, as something that really happened. And through associating with these people in the present and in the past, I developed gradually more insight into really who God is and what the possibilities of what God can do. We see that God, or in our tradition, Krishna, he has the sun and all the planets in their orbits. He has these massive clouds with millions of gallons of water floating in the sky. There's incredible, unbelievable, inconceivable, miraculous events taking place all around us all the time, but because it's happening all the time, we just take it for granted. So if that's some same one absolute personality who can do all this within creation wants to descend into this world, God could do incredible things. That's why he comes. To reveal opulence, to attract us back to love and to service and to goodness. At the same time, these narrations do have very metaphorical, symbolic lessons to learn. And according to our particular level of realization, I think we should be very happy if a person is even taking it to be symbolic, to learn sacred lessons. And if the result of that is learning how to live with integrity, with high character, with devotion, gradually learning to love God, then by God's grace, we can understand that God can do and has done these wonderful things.
Thank you. You both represent ancient religious traditions. Today, many people see hypocrisy in religion and consider themselves spiritual but not religious. So there's an anti-institutional tendency amongst many spiritual seekers. Can you talk about this tension between religion and spirituality, or do you not see a tension?
I see so many tensions. In Sanskrit, there's a phrase, saragrahi, that a truly religious or truly spiritual person is one who seeks the essence. And all the various institutional rules and laws and the various rituals which differ according to religious and times and places and people, they're all meant to connect us to that divinity, to that grace that is within our hearts, and help us to be instruments of that grace. Yoga, Sanskrit word, means to reunite. Religion, I believe it's a Greek word, comes from the Greek word religio, which means to bind back. They both mean to bind us back, to reconnect us to our own essence, to Ishvara, to the Lord, who is within, beyond, and everywhere, ultimately. So sometimes religion is defined as the institutional ritualistic practices which have a tendency to divide us, and spirituality is a more internal experience. But actually, true religion, true spirituality is to practice our rituals, to practice our meditations, to practice in our tradition, we chant the names of God is the primary way of connecting, seeking the essence. And when we seek the essence, we can actually experience the unifying, harmonious truth that is really what brings us all together, like a string that binds together flowers in a garland.
I think the first thing to be said is that we obviously live in an age when belonging to something is a hard thing to do. You know that book from a few years ago about bowling alone? How all these kind of, even just ordinary institutions of bowling leagues and little league and so on like that have broken down, and people tend to be, you know, checking their iPhone and doing their own thing, but don't want to wear a cap with a symbol on it and don't want to be part of the group doing this or the group doing that. And then I think it's been enhanced. I mean, we're children of the 60s, but from the 60s on, this enormous sense that the institutions have failed us, not just churches or temples, but the government has failed us, Congress has failed us, our social institutions have failed us, our universities are sometimes cut off from the needs of people. We know all of this, and where the papers are constantly bringing out the hypocrisies, you know, all the hidden scandals, all the corruption, all the ways in which one thing is being said and something else is being done, and you can look at the political campaigns. There's all this talk, but it doesn't lead to anything. So all of that's the place in which an institution like the Catholic Church is sort of prime and ready to be knocked over. And we know, and you know, you can sift through the papers almost every week and find some scandal of the Catholic Church somewhere in the world. And some of them are terribly tragic and terribly awful and inexcusable, and people at the top are responsible. And I think there is a tendency, and I can see for young people to say, why should I bother with that? Let's just put it aside and go off on my own. And these institutions need to be called to be accountable. That it's not enough to say, well, God, let us be what we are, and therefore we have no accountability. No, I think people in an institution have to give the institution a hard time because they love it. One of my favorite Catholics is another Catholic who spent a long time in New York, Dorothy Day, a founder of the Catholic Worker, lived for a long time on the Lower East Side, running soup kitchens, passive resistance to war and so on like that. But she said the kind of idea is, you know, if you're a Catholic, either love the church or leave it. But if you love it and stay, then you have the obligation to be kind of the loyal opposition, to stay in the church, to follow the rules, to care about the church, to respect hierarchical powers, and then say, however, the church is always falling away from its ideals and always has to be changed. The final thing I'll say is, why bother? And I think Swami has already said this in a way that we can kind of romanticize our own spiritual journeys and romanticize the fact I'll do it better on my own. But in the Catholic tradition, original sin is not just out there. Original sin is in here. And I will mess it up. I will fall by the wayside. I will be the same hypocrite, the same hierarch, the same arrogant person, the same blind person as the leaders of the tradition. And the other side of a tradition and a church or a temple is the institution that kind of forces us to be honest, forces us out of ourselves, and that jostling shoulders in church or temple on the weekend can somehow say, you know, me by myself, I'll just be worse than all of them. But somehow when I'm in dialogue and conversation with people around me who are also imperfect Catholics, that somehow we end up being better off than we would have been if each of us becomes our own pope. So it's a tricky thing, and I think some kind of prophetic questioning of the institution is absolutely necessary, but the other extreme of saying, I will be better off without it, is in rare cases true, but most of the time it's not a good idea, I would say. Thank you.
Can you speak to the feminine aspects of the divine in your respective traditions, Father Clifton?
One, if you know anything about the Christian churches and Roman Catholic tradition, the prayer is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And there's this great sense that the Father of the Jewish people, the Father of the Church, the Son comes into the world. And it often seems as if the presence of the feminine is not there. And if you read feminist critiques of traditional churches like the Catholic Church, where did the feminine go? Where did the goddess go? Pushed out the door. And yet I think that is, again, an institutional problem about even tussling about language used in worship and so on. These issues always come to the fore. But it's never that simple. And on the one side, I would say that, you know, if we begin to, we read with eyes open to issues of gender, we're alert to these issues, we're alert to the kind of the inequalities in the institutions to which we belong and who's in charge and who's not allowed to speak and so on like that. But once we begin to look at it differently, we realize that many of the attributes of God, let's say in the Bible, are actually that of the loving mother, the mother who cares for her children, the one who is compassionate, the one who is not just the warrior God, but has these other dimensions of the divine personality that also creep back in. I think also, I wrote a book a few years ago called Divine Mother, Blessed Mother, Hindu Goddesses and the Virgin Mary. And I was concerned about the fact that, you know, many of us who are not Hindu and study Hinduism, we would look at Advaita Vedanta, Mimamsa, Krishna, Rama, and so on. But as Swami said before, there is Radha, there is Shri, there is Lakshmi, there is Mahadevi. And that somehow all that is so evident and open in Hindu tradition, Ramakrishna and his mother, all of this somehow offers an opportunity and a challenge back to the Christian churches. And what I found is that if I go into church on Sunday or a classroom at a Catholic university and say, well, now we should all pray to the goddess instead because that's a good idea for the 21st century, it's not going to go anywhere. But rather to look back and say, the feminine is real. This is not a human invention. The feminine divine nature of God as the mother is somehow present in our tradition. And I tried to retrieve in that book the Virgin Mary. It's obvious for a Catholic. that there's this kind of improbable presence right in the center of the tradition. If you go into Catholic churches, even around here, images of Jesus and then these very large statues of the Virgin Mary. And people go and they'll say hello to Jesus and then go ask Mary for the, you know, pour out their hearts to Mary. There's a way in which this kind of displacement, the language of the Bible often makes it seem impossible to pray to God as mother or the element of the female. And yet somehow it comes back in, and for Roman Catholics, improbably the mother of Jesus becomes this very central figure, that to be Catholic and to have devotion to Mary becomes part of the center of the faith. This doesn't say, therefore, everything is okay and everything is balanced, but I think it does show that even a tradition that has very inadequate language about gender or male and female in the divine finds a way to bring it back in, and that while Mary is not in Catholic tradition God, that somehow the centrality of Mary and the impossibility of thinking of the Church without the role of Mary is opening the door to saying all those feminine attributes come back right into the heart of Christianity. But it remains a problem, but at least there are possibilities there.
Thank you. There is a verse in our scripture, Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir Ladini Shakti Ratma, which means the absolute truth, or God, is one. One God manifesting in so many religions and so many times, so many forms. The absolute truth, the source of everything, is one. And that one is eternally two, as both male and female. The male and female aspect of that one God are equally the one God. In our tradition, it's Radha Krishna, or Sita Ram, Lakshmi Narayan. The male aspect of the Lord is the Vishaya. The female is Ashraya. That means Krishna is the supreme, all-attractive object of love. Radha is the supreme abode of love. She's the ultimate source and reservoir of all love. And therefore, the feminine aspect of God is the source in our tradition of grace. And it is only through that grace that we could be forgiven, that we can be empowered to actually love God. I took this very interesting when I went to Vrindavan. At least 75% of the time, people were greeting each other with Radha's name. And I was wondering, why is this? Because in this culture, in this theology, approaching the feminine aspect of God is actually the way to receive grace. And it is that grace that showers us and cleanses us and makes and actually empowers us to love. So the feminine aspect of the divinity is a very integral, prominent aspect of bhakti, inseparable from the masculine aspect of divinity.
You have both spoken of a calling to take to this path of love of God. You both thought of call at some point beginning of your journeys. For many of us who might not have had such a moment of clarity, for the rest of us who might not have had such a moment of clarity, to what extent, if any, is the role of a spiritual teacher, a guru-type figure, essential to foster love of God in humanity? So those of us that haven't had that calling, to what extent does a spiritual guru-type figure important? And how do you both approach trying to embody that? Because you are a guru, Swami, maybe you are a priest and you have a congregation. So how do you embody that role of guru? To what extent is it important, and how do you both embody that practice?
Somehow or other, I only went to one semester of junior college. Here I am speaking at Columbia University, Ivy League school. After that one semester, I went on my journey and never came home. But for those of you who have studied, whether it's music or academics, it's important to have teachers. Just like if a person tells you, you need a heart surgery, I'll do it. You'll probably want to understand that this person has not only read the books, but has gone to the schools where he has actually understood the traditional practical application of these books. So even in ordinary academic studies, having a teacher is very necessary. It's very priceless, especially for subjects that are beyond our own intelligence and beyond our own abilities. And spiritual subject matter is the deepest, it's the subtlest, it's the highest of all subjects. And therefore, throughout traditional spirituality, we find universally the great necessity of having teachers, having gurus, who not only can explain the essence of a teaching, because there appears to be sometimes so many contradictions, and also, how do I apply this to my life? We could make a lot of mistakes. But a guru is a person who embodies the teachings, clarifies the true essence of the teachings, and by his or her example and words, teaches us how to practically apply these teachings to our life in such a way that we spiritually grow, that we actually make progress toward the true goal. The Bhagavatam, there's a beautiful verse, Savai Pungshang Paro Dharmo Yato Bhaktir Hok Kache Ahoitaki Aprati Hata Yayatma Suprasidati, which means the supreme dharma, the supreme religion, the supreme occupation is to awaken from within our own hearts love for God and to serve God with that love. And for that love to satisfy the heart, it must be unmotivated by any selfishness, arrogance, or greed, and uninterrupted by any circumstances or reversals that may come in our life. And a teacher, a guru, is one who helps us to remain focused on that goal and make progress toward it. And there are different types of gurus. There are shiksha gurus that are many. Anybody who's really inspiring us through their example and words. And there's the diksha guru, one who is actually giving formal initiation. And they're all working together for that divine purpose.
Imagine if you had gone to college for a whole year.
I don't know what would have happened to me.
I think I would just say several things to start. I mean, one would be, first of all, that I think we all have vocations and we all find our way. I mean, why are you sitting here today? Those of you who are studying at Columbia, why are you studying at Columbia and not somewhere else? That in the course of our lives, we sort out what is meaningful to us, what gives us happiness, what is in keeping with the talents we have, things that are not foreclosed by extraneous events and so on like that. We find our way in life. Sometimes some of us have this kind of sense of inner intensity, and you follow you march to your own drummer, and you find your own way by yourself. And others are extremely interactive, and you talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, and then you find your way. But I think the first thing is that in life we do find our vocations, not everybody all the time, but most of us manage. And then in the religious realm, it's going to be like that too. Some look within and some look around more, I think is the case. I do think, again, those of you who are, let's say, studying here at Columbia and younger, it's a hard time in which to do that because the consensus has broken down about what counts or what's valuable. I went to Regis High School a couple of miles from here, and every year a number of the boys graduating from school became Jesuits. There was like this, cultural push. Right after me, 1968, it kind of dropped off the cliff and stopped happening. But there was a sense of course, if you're smart, you're Catholic, you're devout, become a Jesuit. The vocation was kind of a cultural thing. And even though I said that I had this very intense experience when I was 15 that changed my life, that was in a context in which this value was held up of Jesuit priest and the like. So all of that, I think, it's both we find our way, and yet the culture can be against giving a clear message to anyone today. What does it mean to be a truly religious person, and what do you do with your life? The second thing I would say is that given that context, my tradition, the Jesuit tradition, St. Ignatius Loyola, our founder, said, how do you find your vocation in life? There are three different ways. One is a few people are like St. Paul. And in the Acts of the Apostles, Paul is going to Damascus to persecute the Christians. He gets knocked down, a blinding light. He's no longer Saul, he's Paul. Some people have it that way, like their life changes all at once. Some people, Ignatius says, basically have to get out their pen and paper or their iPad or something like that and sort it out, pros and cons. I mean, what are the pros and cons of becoming a monk or joining a religious order or being a social worker or being a teacher? Pros and cons, because almost everything we do in life, pros and cons. And that God, who may in sense be with us, is not giving any advice. There are no lights, no voices, no loud noises or anything. Figure it out for yourself. And when you look back 40 years later, you say, okay, I could have done something else. Maybe I didn't need to be a teacher or a social worker, but I think I did the best I could with my paper, pros and cons. The third category, and this finally relates to the idea of the guru or the director, is Ignatius says that between the blinding light on the road that Paul had and rationally thinking it out for yourself as best you can, are the fact that God is constantly communicating in our lives all kinds of feelings that are hard to sort out, lights and darknesses, consolations, desolations, moments of inspiration, moments of despair, fears and longings. And that to have somebody to talk to about that, to voice it, to other it, I mean, to make it vocal and then have somebody feed it back to you, not because the other person, in almost all cases, is going to be in a superior position of wisdom by which he or she will say, okay, this is what you do with your life, but because just, we're human beings and we learn by talking, we learn by hearing from others. And if you spill out what's inside your soul and all its ambiguities to another person, that person can feed back to you and say, do you see these tendencies? Do you see these trends? And in religious orders, in parishes and so on college campuses, often the spiritual director is the one who doesn't tell you what to do with your life, but rather says, given what's going on in your life, it seems that God is drawing you this way or that way. So I think Catholic tradition, despite its hierarchies, is fairly skeptical of gurus, that we don't have authoritative figures who tell people things. But Swami has already said it, diksha, shiksha, there can be subtle varieties. But rather, everybody is already in the presence of God. God is working in your life. Somebody can guide you by hearing what you're saying and then feeding it back to you.
So I think we have time for one more question, and I apologize to everybody who wrote questions who didn't have time to get them in, but maybe you can come up afterwards and speak, engage our speakers. So one last question, and I'm just going to invite Father Clooney and Radha Swami just to finish up with a few words. And the question is probably the oldest question known to mankind. Who am I? Father Tony.
Well, you are Edwin Bryant and you teach at Rutgers University. Is that what you're asking? No. I think, who am I? I mean, it relates to the previous answer I gave, is that, you know, there's kind of the external story. So we're people of the 21st century now. We're living in America. We're living on the East Coast. We're living in places like Boston and New York. There are all kinds of issues about our social location, our economic status, our families, our educational opportunities, all this kind of stuff around us, which is not unimportant. All of that, I think, is at stake. Then there are personal journeys, the kind of thing you write in your diary or share with only a few friends about your loves, your desires, your fears, your despairs, your hopes, your longings, your loneliness, what gives you life, all of those kind of inner stories. And that stuff, too, is who we are. I think on a theological level, you know, in a Catholic tradition, who am I? I am a child of God. I am somebody whom God loves intensely. God has called out of nothing into being. God has given a sense of a direction in life. You are the one, I am the one whom God cares for and will not abandon. I am the one who God has given a community, brothers and sisters, both of my own tradition and others around me. All of this stuff is true. And all of these things, I think, need to be taken into account. But the existential question, the ultimate question of who am I think is the kind of question, you know, you really have to be, you're alone. You stand and you look in the mirror and you kind of, without any illusions, look at your life and say, all this stuff I've said about myself, all this stuff that I portray to others, if I strip all of that away and the sort of the nothingness that I am, to not be afraid of that and say at some deep level, you have to do it yourself and say, whatever the theology, whatever the culture, the education, et cetera, at some point to ask that very powerful and frightening question, who am I? Look into the, you know, the light and darkness of who we are, and then say in some way, I affirm it. I am good. I am not going to run away from who I am, because the only person I'll ever be is who I am. And it's a gift I've received. It may not be the gift I wanted, but by asking that question and doing it without any romance, to somehow trust that I, who I am, is God's gift to the world. And that may be a question I need to ask when I'm 20 and 30, but at 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, it's a ruthless question again. And we never just ask it once, but we keep coming back to it because we have to keep stripping away all the ways that we've made it comfortable to allow the mystery again to be open.
Thank you. The Gita begins especially on this subject, the question, who am I? Dehinosmin yatha dehe komaram yovanam jana. That the conscious force, the living force that is within us, sees through the eyes, hears through the ears, tastes through the tongue, thinks through the brain, loves through the heart, that living force passes through so many transitions. At one time we were little babies, and then we were young children, then adolescents and, you know, teenagers. Then we get old, middle age. We're both 61 years old. And eventually, the body dies. So who is it that was witnessing all of these changes? If you show me a picture of yourself, a photograph of when you're a little baby, I may not recognize you, but that's me. That means I was in that body. The body is compared to a vehicle or like a set of clothes. And the mind, the intelligence, and the ego is like a subtle set of clothes. Just like we have our pants and shirts, and under that we have our underwear. But we're the person underneath it. The body changes, and the mind's always changing. But who is that witness? That is the Atma, the living force, the soul. And the Gita explains, Najayate Mriyate Vakadachit, the nature of that Atma, is that it is unborn, it is undying, it is eternal. Mamaivam so jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. Krishna tells that every living being, that atma, is part and parcel of God. Just like the sun planet, from the sun planet are unlimited little sun rays. And each sun ray is qualitatively exactly identical to the sun planet, but quantitatively just a little portion. And in the Gita's tradition, this is the nature of the soul. We are part of God. We are eternal. We are light. And within us, our greatest potential is the inner fulfillment of love for God, love for all beings, to see that wherever there is life is a sacred part of God. You see, we could change our religion. We could change our nationality. These days, you can even change your sex. So we can change all these things, and our mind is always changing. I think we have that experience. But who am I? I am the divine spark of God. Lord Chaitanya, he began an incredible exposition of divine teachings to Sanatana Goswami, and begins it with a very simple statement. Jivera Swarupoi Krishnera Nitya Das. Our eternal identity, that which is inseparable. Just like the dharma, or the inseparable quality of a chili pepper, is to be hot. The inseparable quality of sugar is to be sweet. The inseparable quality of our true self is to love God, is to be an instrument of compassion in whatever we do. That is our nature. And unfortunately, all of the conflicts in the world are due to this ahankar, this ego of misidentifying who we really are. If I think I'm Hindu, or I'm Jewish, or I'm Christian, or I'm Islamic, then we're divided from so many people. Or I'm American, or I'm German, or I'm Pakistani, or I'm Indian, or I'm Palestinian, or I'm an Israeli, or I'm male or female, young or old. These are all there to be respected. But beyond that, we're all united. If we understand the spiritual essence of who I really am as an eternal, loving servant of the Lord, beyond birth, beyond death.
So, thank you both for your insights and sincerity, and thank you everybody for coming today. I'd like to just conclude that with maybe inviting both our speakers just to finish up with a few words of guidance for those of us that are spiritual seekers, and I assume many of us are, and that's why we're here. Sometimes it really feels like, despite our best spiritual efforts, we are really not encountering God, but remain very far. So as guides within your respective traditions, would you care to share a few words of guidance for us today in terms of how we can keep inspired in our spiritual journeys, and why is that important?
Two things. One would be, I think many questions are in your heads and many questions are written down we didn't get to. If you want to email me, I'd be happy to entertain further questions by email. Gadadhara Swami has my email address. It's totally secret, but he'll give it to you, just to you. Seriously, if you want to follow up with a question that we didn't get to, please don't be shy about asking for the email address, or ask me for it afterwards. Second thing, just a little bit of a parable, and I'll stop with this. In the 1930s, this guy comes here to study at Columbia. French, English parents, kind of vaguely Christian, but not particularly committed to anything, kind of adrift in life. He comes to Columbia to study literature in the 1930s, looking around, kind of living kind of a vaguely secular life, but basically unhappy with it all. A Hindu Swami comes through, Brahmachari, comes through Columbia, improbably come for a conference to the U.S., ends up studying at the University of Chicago. Brahmachari comes, this guy goes running to him. Brahmachari asks, you know, what should I do with my life? Should I follow you, be your disciple? And Brahmachari says to him, what you should do is study your own tradition. Go read the masters of your Christian tradition. So this kid suddenly is shocked that he has to go and read Christian classics. He goes to the little Catholic parish, which is on one of the side streets here, and the name slips me at the moment, but it's the Catholic parish for Columbia. He goes there, starts going on a regular basis. He begins to be intensely involved with it, and he's kind of fascinated by this. He decides to become a Catholic out of his vaguely Christian background. One day he's down in Lower Manhattan on 15th Street in Chelsea. He walks by Francis Xavier, the Catholic church there. He thinks the door is locked. He opens it. It's open. At an improbable time of the day, he goes in. The priest is holding up the consecrated host. And suddenly he realizes, God's calling me to be a priest. This person is the author of A Seven-Story Mountain, Thomas Merton, Brother Lewis of the Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky. And it's a profound story because it's this improbable kid who's improbably wandering around the Columbia campus, runs into a Hindu monk who suddenly gives him unexpected advice, changes his life. He wanders into a local church, he wanders into another church, and he becomes one of the great Christian Catholic spiritual masters of the 20th century. He finds that God was already at work in his story. In all those earlier scenes of his life when he thought nothing was happening, God was already speaking to him. He suddenly felt him called to this radical life in the monastery. He became a figure improbably from the monastery in the civil rights movement, in the anti-war movement. At the very end of his life, he was in Thailand talking to Buddhist monks about Christian Buddhist monastic spirituality. And why do I tell you this? Because you're here. You're at Columbia. And that somehow to have the utter confidence that as that happened for Thomas Merton, it's happening for you. Your story with God is being written. The work of God is happening in your life. Pay attention. Don't be worried if for periods of time you don't hear anything, because the day will come when the door will open, the advice will be given, and you realize that you have a vocation, and that just as Merton found this way, you will find your way, and all that you've been seeking from God, you will find. So have that sense of hope, whatever questions you may have, that you will not waste your time. You will find your way, even right here.
Beautiful thing. The world today is really in a very crucial state. There's nuclear bombs. There's so much hatred and conflict within religions, within nations, within races. The ecology is being exploited in so many ways, which endangers so much the life we know. There's a need for real change. I think our President Obama, this was his campaign slogan in his last election, is change. There really is a great need for change. And as we explained at the beginning, unless we change ourselves, we can't really be a part of a real solution. If we want to clean the ecology of the world, we really have to focus on cleaning the ecology of our own minds. Greed, real spirituality, real dharma, real religion is transformation. Transformation of arrogance into humility, greed into generosity, hate into love, vengeance into forgiveness, agitation into peace, light or darkness into light. Within the world, whatever knowledge we have, whatever money we have, whatever skills we have, they could potentially be of great benefit, or they could be very destructive, depending on our motives, our wisdom, and our character. So as our beloved Father Clooney has been describing, there requires a serious balance. This is a magnificent hall, but what holds it up, it's its foundation. As we're trying to build our lives through our education, through our occupations, through our different relationships, we should also be very much focused on having a strong foundation in our lives, wherein we can maintain character, integrity, and spiritual wisdom and love, even when there's temptations, that we can get so much more if we just compromise. Or even if there's fear that I could lose so much if I compromise my values, my ideals. For this, we need a strong spiritual foundation. And spirituality, religion, is not about necessarily becoming a swami or a priest. It's about balancing our lives with this foundation, being an instrument of compassion. Yat karoshi yadashnasi yat johoshi dudasiyat. Whether we're engineers or doctors or teachers or accountants or farmers or bankers or mothers or fathers or swamis or priests, if we perform our duties in a spirit of devotion, with wisdom, then we can make a real change in the world. And that takes cleansing the ecology of our heart. In my tradition, the powerful recommendation is chanting God's names. Mantra means mind, to free the mind of the ecological pollutions of greed and envy and anger. And the sound vibration, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, is a mantra that serves that purpose. And in the Christian, Jewish, Islamic, or other branches of Hindu faith, Buddhism, there are various mantras, transcendental sounds, prayers, and ways in which we endeavor to actually cleanse the heart, actually come in contact with this spiritual power, with this grace that gives us a foundation that whatever we do in our life, we can build something wonderful and make some real changes in the world that we live in. And we all have that opportunity. And this is so exciting. Life really is an adventure if we see it from this perspective. There are infinite possibilities of how we could do something wonderful in this world. Because God's grace is infinite. It's beyond us if we just tune in, connect. I would just like to close by thanking Father Clooney for your words of wisdom and your friendship. It's wonderful to be able to share this time with you. Thank you very much.
We get another applause for Dr.